From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we look at some of the changes in the world of nuclear weapons. Last year, India tested 5 nuclear bombs. Last month, the U.S. Senate voted against ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We'll talk with George Perkovich, author of India's Nuclear Bomb, which examines how and why India developed the bomb and what that can teach us about global proliferation. Also, we remember writer Paul Bowles, the writer Norman Mailer described as opening up the world of hip. He died today at the age of 88 from a heart attack in Tangiers, Morocco, his home for more than 50 years. His best-known novel is A Sheltering Sky. We'll listen to an excerpt of our 1993 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has approved a $390 billion spending package for the current fiscal year. White House and congressional negotiators reached agreement on the bill after weeks of talks. Both sides have declared victory, but some interest groups aren't as happy as others. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Among hundreds of compromises in the bill is one that would free up almost $1 billion in overdue U.S. payments to the United Nations. In exchange for the UN money, the administration agreed to restrictions on abortion-related activities by international family planning groups. Abortion rights activists have blasted the plan, even though President Clinton is likely to waive the restrictions. They want the president to get rid of the limits completely next year. Anti-abortion groups say the agreement didn't go as far as they'd like, but that it's an important step in their campaign against abortion. The National Right to Life Committee called the agreement a limited success. The group said election of a pro-life president is the only way to make the restrictions stick. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Rescue workers in College Station, Texas, are carefully lifting logs from a pile of lumber that collapsed early this morning, killing at least 9 students as they stacked the logs for their annual bonfire. Officials say more than 24 students were hurt when the stack gave way, and another 5 students may still be unaccounted for. As many as 70 students were working on the 40-foot stack of logs when it came crashing down. The bonfire is a Texas A&M tradition, lit the night before the school's yearly football game against the University of Texas. Tomorrow, the 54 members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe will sign a charter calling for a political solution in Chechnya. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Istanbul.
The agreement on a charter followed a day of debate about Chechnya. Western leaders condemned the Russian policy. Boris Yeltsin was defiant, saying the West had no right to criticize Russia. The document the organization will sign says there should be a political solution in Chechnya, and that Russia will invite the head of the OSCE to visit Chechnya soon. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was not overly optimistic about what it could accomplish.
This is a longer-term problem, and I think that we need to keep pushing it along, and we have been given more tools to deal with it.
The OSCE has offered itself as a mediator in the Chechen conflict, but the Russian defense minister says there's no one in Chechnya for the OSCE to negotiate with. Mara Liasson, NPR News, with the president in Istanbul.
A jury in Jasper, Texas says Sean Allen Berry should spend the rest of his life in prison for dragging a black man to death behind a pickup truck. Berry was the last of 3 white men to be convicted of the killing. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 153 points to close at 11,036. This is NPR. Federal safety investigators, aviation experts, and translators will work through the weekend in an effort to determine what caused the crash of Egypt Air 990. They're focusing on the plane's cockpit voice recorder and the apparent sequence of events in the minutes before the plane plunged into the ocean. Some investigators have focused on the possibility that a relief co-pilot may have caused the plane to dive, but Egyptians say there was no apparent motive for the act and that, as a devout Muslim, the man would never have committed suicide. The 2 Democratic presidential hopefuls courted Jewish leaders today at a meeting in Atlanta. Both Vice President Al Gore and former Senator Bill Bradley emphasized their unwavering support for Israel. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Gore and Bradley went after the votes of a critical Democratic constituency yesterday. In separate appearances, the two spoke to the United Jewish Community's General Assembly meeting in Atlanta. Bradley held a reception for the group and told members that he had a perfect record on votes critical to Israel during his 18 years in the Senate. Gore addressed the same group yesterday afternoon and said the United States will always stand with Israel when it takes risks for peace. Meanwhile, the two candidates are in the midst of a dispute over a new ad released by the Bradley campaign. The ad features a stay-at-home mother who says legislation sponsored by Bradley that allowed for longer hospital stays saved her daughter's life. The Gore campaign maintains the woman's complicated delivery actually occurred several years before the Bradley bill passed. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News.
Hurricane Lenny is battering the Leeward Islands of the Caribbean with winds of 120 miles per hour. The storm is currently stalled off St. Martin. Lenny is blamed for at least four deaths. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to look at some of the changes in the nuclear landscape. Last year, India tested five nuclear weapons. At the same time, Pakistan conducted its own nuclear tests. And last summer, the two South Asian countries came dangerously close to using nuclear weapons as fighting escalated over the control of the disputed region of Kashmir. My guest, George Pergovich, is the author of the new book, India's Nuclear Bomb, The Impact on Global Proliferation. He directs the Secure World Program of the W. Alton Jones Foundation and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. The U.S. and other Western countries tried to get India and Pakistan to stop expanding their nuclear programs through economic sanctions, political disapproval, and pressuring them to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. But last month, the U.S. Senate voted against ratifying the treaty. I asked George Pergovich to explain the treaty's most important points.
Well, basically, since 1963, nuclear weapon tests have been banned everywhere except under the Earth's surface. And so this treaty would then extend the ban, and it would say you cannot conduct nuclear weapon tests of any kind, including under the Earth. Now, there's a loophole that allows what are called subcritical tests, tiny, tiny tests that don't even have an explosive yield. You could do them in a laboratory. But beyond that, anything that we kind of picture as making the Earth shake and a big boom, that would be now proscribed. And then on top of that would be created an international monitoring system with, I think, more than 300 seismic stations around the world to detect whether there are explosions underground that need to be investigated as possible kind of suspicious nuclear tests. And there's a whole set of rules then that would go into enforcing and acting upon any doubts that a country has. So basically it rules out the big boom that we're, you know, used to seeing.
What were the main reasons that the senators who voted against the U.S. signing this treaty gave for it?
Well, there were two explicit reasons, and then there was kind of one underlying reason that became explicit sometimes. The two explicit reasons were the treaty may not be fully verifiable. In other words, a country might be able to conduct small nuclear tests that would go undetected. Now, that argument has a lot of problems with it, but this was one of the points they made. And then the second big argument that was made by critics of the treaty was that the U.S. would not be able to maintain its nuclear weapons forever without having to go back and test them. That somehow the weapons would degrade in some way, and therefore they would become, quote, unreliable, and thus we shouldn't rule out testing. Now, beyond those two explicit arguments, the underlying point that a lot of the critics made was, look, we're ahead. We have the best nuclear weapons in the world. We got the best nuclear scientists in the world. We're the greatest power in the world. When you're ahead like that, you don't tie your hands behind your back because you give the other guys a chance to catch up. Use this advantage. So why do we want to restrain ourselves?
How many countries have the bomb now?
Well, there are five countries that are recognized as having nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, China, the United Kingdom, and France. There are three countries that have nuclear weapons but are not legally recognized as such, and that's India, Pakistan, and Israel. Then there are probably several other countries that are believed to have various ambitions. North Korea, for example, is a country that the United States believes has between zero and two nuclear weapons. And there's an agreement with North Korea that you hear about every few months when there's a dispute in negotiations, but there's an agreement whereby they've frozen their program to build nuclear weapons. Iraq also had a nuclear weapon program, but as we know, that was hopefully curtailed, and we're bombing Iraq basically every day in a way enforcing that. And then Iran is believed to have a nascent program trying to acquire nuclear weapons.
Let's bring India into the picture. Mm-hmm. Your new book is about how India developed nuclear weapons and the impact of that on global proliferation. India tested five nuclear weapons last year. What's the impact of India having nuclear weapons in this period where, you know, on the one hand we have nuclear non-proliferation treaty, on the other hand, the U.S. Senate just voted down the comprehensive test ban treaty? Yeah.
Well, I think the impact of India having nuclear weapons is going to evolve, but one of the things it says to the 179 or thereabouts countries that don't have nuclear weapons, it says to them, well, wait a minute, now there's one more member of the club. We thought it was going to be limited to five. Now there's six, and then Pakistan makes it seven, and then Israel, which nobody wants to talk about, is eight. And so if that's the trend, if the number is going to grow, which I don't think it will, but if it does, that's very unsettling to the rest of the world, and people in other countries may start looking around and saying, well, we've got to start hedging our bets.
You say that U.S. policymakers make certain assumptions about why countries want to develop nuclear weapons, but that India developed nuclear weapons for reasons that the United States doesn't always take into account. What are some of those reasons, and what are the reasons policymakers here usually assume countries want the bomb for?
There's a general assumption in the U.S. and in the West that countries seek nuclear weapons for military security reasons. Mm-hmm. There's some objective threat out there, and people go into a bureaucracy and they make these very careful, rational calculations that we need nuclear weapons to counteract this military threat. It's all a very objective kind of process, the way we're taught and the way we assume. Well, in fact, it's much more subjective and political than that. Personalities matter a great deal. Individuals may want nuclear weapons, and if they're charismatic and they're persuasive and they're well-placed, as Homi Bhabha, the chief Indian scientist in the 40s and 50s was, they might be able to put the country on a course of getting nuclear weapons. And then there are other dimensions. What's the country's image of itself, of its role in the world? India was just coming out of the colonial history and wanted to be a great power in Asia first and then in the world. So there was this profound anti-colonialism. And it was seen that nuclear weapons represented modernity and great prowess. And if you could build nuclear weapons, you would have achieved what only the greatest countries in the world had achieved. And somehow, by doing that, then you would elevate yourself to that level. And
so
that
it gives you status.
Gives you great status. And so that was very compelling in India. And I would argue it's compelling potentially in other countries like Iran, who countries where there's a narrative, where there's a story of great civilization and great ambition. And as long as the U.S. and the other so-called great powers have nuclear weapons and refuse to give them up, that elevates this currency or this status and makes it very attractive for countries like India to try to follow after. And so I think that awareness that there's a lot more kind of at the human level, at the psychological level, at the cultural level, that affects the way people look at nuclear weapons is important and is generally lost in many of the deliberations in the United States.
When a country like the U.S. pressures a country like India to not develop nuclear weapons, how is that interpreted in India? And I'm wondering if you think like the race issue comes into play.
Yes, I think when the U.S., especially as the leader of the international system, puts a lot of pressure on India, you know, not to develop nuclear weapons, it's basically seen in India as a replay of colonialism. So that this whole system, this non-proliferation regime, is in many ways seen as a colonial construct where the white countries basically try to keep dark-skinned countries from getting nuclear weapons. And that's totally unacceptable to India because it plays into the whole history that, you know, where they struggled so hard to overcome this. And there are too many moments where it's seen that the U.S. is being, in fact, racially insensitive or colonialistic in its approach. So I have many quotes in the book, for example, where India does something technologically, and then some, you know, American scientist or official says, they can't really do it. That's a fraud. And to an Indian, it's then, and I quote people saying, well, you know, these white guys assume a black man or a dark-skinned man can't do this kind of thing. So what else do you expect them to say? Or, for example, when we put embargoes or block exports of certain technology to India, that's seen straight out as a reimposition of colonialism. They don't want us to develop technologically. They want us to stay poor so we can be a source of cheap labor. They'll buy raw materials from us, but they don't want us to get into manufacturing. Therefore, they won't sell us their computers and other things. So it comes through over and over again. And you see, for example, this issue, even in, you know, Salman Rushdie and Michael Ondaatje, in their novels, The English Patient and Midnight's Children, there's mentioning of nuclear weapons, but it's seen as this is something that, you know, white power used against brown-skinned people. And it's vivid when you spend enough time working on this. And I don't know what can be done about it, but at least kind of greater awareness that it's an issue that's out there, and it's uncomfortable and awkward, but you have to recognize it.
During the Cold War, America had all these kind of policies defining how we would use nuclear weapons or describing why we had so many nuclear weapons. You know, there was deterrence. Our nuclear weapons would prevent another country from bombing us. Mutually assured destruction, well, if another country is foolish enough to bomb us, mm-hmm. we'll destroy them, and that will prevent them from even thinking about bombing us in the first place. Does India have any kind of nuclear theology guiding its arsenal?
Yeah, India is in the process now of thinking through and articulating and writing down what its nuclear doctrine is going to be. What I found most interesting, what actually drew me into studying this subject 7 years ago, was at that time, in the early 90s, India had a very unique perspective, very different perspective than we have on nuclear deterrence. And the basic view they had was, look, as long as a potential adversary has some doubt about whether they could get away with hitting us without getting hit back with nuclear weapons, that's basically enough. These things, these weapons are so destructive and so mind-boggling in many ways that as long as somebody has uncertainty about getting away with it, that's what you need. Now, that's very different from the way the U.S. Has conducted nuclear operations. Our whole posture has been predicated on absolute certainty. So it's not enough that someone have a doubt. They have to be absolutely certain that within minutes of their even beginning to launch nuclear weapons, they're going to get hit, and they're going to get hit, you know, not in 10 cities, but thousands of targets are going to be destroyed. And so you had this very kind of hyperactive, what was called overkill, approach to deterrence. And the Indian was very different. Now in India, there was just released actually a draft nuclear doctrine this August. And it sounds alarmingly closer to the way that the U.S. has always approached nuclear weapons than to the way that India for a number of decades thought about these things, which I would argue was a lot more interesting as an approach to deterrence than the practice of the United States and the Soviet Union was.
My guest is George Perkovich. He is the author of the new book, India's Nuclear Bomb, The Impact on Global Proliferation. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is George Perkovich. He's the author of the new book, India's Nuclear Bomb, The Impact on Global Proliferation. How far does the development of India's bomb date back?
Oh, India began its nuclear program most broadly right at independence, even before, but say 1948. And then I think the architects of that program, including Prime Minister Nehru, had in mind developing a nuclear explosive from at least the mid-50s on. The kind of explicit work to actually design explosives really began in the mid-60s.
How did the concept for the bomb catch on in a period in the period of Gandhi of passive resistance? And you know, Nehru was a man of peace. Mm-hmm.
This is one of the paradoxes in the whole legacy of Gandhi is one reason why I think Indians have always been so ambivalent about the bomb. And I write in the book, you know, that Nehru himself, I think, was very ambivalent on this issue, that he learned at the foot of Gandhi, and he really did want India to be morally different in the world, and he really did abhor nuclear weapons. But there was this other part of Nehru who was educated at Cambridge, you know, was a very worldly man, wanted India to be a great power. And so that part of Nehru understood, well, we may need nuclear weapons at some point. And I think he reconciled those two positions by allowing his friend Homi Bhabha, the chief scientist, to go forward and develop the capability, quote, the option to build nuclear weapons without ever, you know, deciding that this is what we would do. But let us have the option, and we'll see how the world evolves, and we may need it. And that you could reconcile that was reconcilable. I don't want nuclear weapons, but we may get driven to it. Let's have the option. And in the meantime, we will demand that the rest of the world get rid of these things. And so that will be our moral position, that everybody should get rid of these. But if people won't over time, let's then have the option to play it the other way. And that's what they did.
What was Pakistan's reason for developing the bomb?
Pakistan was totally unambivalent about this because Pakistan's obsession, understandably, is India. And that Pakistan is much smaller than India, feels vastly inferior kind of militarily to India. And therefore, for Pakistan, it was strictly to develop a military capability to deter and or rebuff India. And they've been charging ahead, you know, kind of quietly and secretly in many ways, but very energetically to develop a military nuclear capability, whereas India was much more ambivalent and wasn't militarizing its nuclear capability. It was more a scientific project in India than a military project. In Pakistan, it's been a military project.
India and Pakistan have been fighting over control of Kashmir virtually ever since the partition of India in 1947. Things really escalated over this past summer. And you say that you think things actually got closer to nuclear war than we even know, you know, than was reported. What's your evidence?
Well, the concern about the conflict in Kargil was that India was not in a position to see whether Pakistan in that conflict was preparing nuclear weapons and mobilizing missiles for potential use. And similarly, Pakistan couldn't see what India was doing because neither of them possessed the kind of satellites that we're used to from Tom Clancy novels and all of these movies where, you know, everybody sits around in the CIA and watches what's happening on the ground. Well, in India and Pakistan, those capabilities don't yet exist. So you have this military conflict going on, and India is feeling aggrieved, understandably. And there was a lot of pressure on the Indian government to go and cross the what's called the line of control in Kashmir and interdict forces from Pakistan on the other side. And then the situation became, well, if we go across that line, do we risk prompting Pakistan to escalate potentially to using nuclear weapons? And we in India, the people who are making this decision, we won't know if they're going to escalate. We won't be able to see it coming. And so this was a very daunting moment, and people were very concerned about it within India. They felt their hands were tied on one level, and that was calming at some level. But on the other hand, there was no real confidence in how Pakistan would respond. And in many ways, one can say that Pakistan may have been tempted to start this conflict last summer, precisely because they now have nuclear weapons, and they felt like they could start this low-level conflict, and India would be deterred from escalating it, because of the threat of nuclear weapons, and therefore you kind of get away with it. And then when you have that logic going, India is in a position where its leaders have to say, well, wait, we can't let them think they can get away with this. And this is why it's very destabilizing.
Last month, there was a military takeover in Pakistan. What went through your mind after it happened, knowing that Pakistan probably has a nuclear weapon?
Well, the military takeover in Pakistan raises all sorts of implications. And so when it was first announced, and it wasn't a great surprise because there was so much trouble in Pakistan, at first there I had a certain sense of relief, and I'll tell you why. It's that there is at least an element in Pakistan that's responsible for building nuclear weapons and missiles there that's out of control. And it's led by a certain scientist who's kind of an egomaniac guy who's very difficult to control. So one thought was, well, that the military finally at least could put this guy under control, where the civilian prime minister may not have been able to do. And so I still believe that's true. I just don't know whether the general's going to want to try to put him under control. And so that's much harder to figure out. The other concern, obviously, was that this was the military that had basically instigated the conflict with India only 6 months ago. And so did they still harbor that general feeling that this kind of aggression was useful or not? And if they did, it was going to be problematic. But I do think it's important to emphasize that for now anyway, the nuclear weapons in Pakistan are under tight military control, and the military there has no interest in kind of losing control of those things.
George Perkovich is the author of India's Nuclear Bomb, The Impact on Global Proliferation. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time Magazine, featuring Time, CBS News, People of the Century, a book profiling 100 men and women who helped shape the last 100 years. Available in bookstores. By Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts, on the web at visx.com. And by Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with George Perkovich, author of India's Nuclear Bomb, and we remember writer Paul Bowles with a 1993 interview. He died today at the age of 88 in Tangiers, Morocco.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with George Perkovich, author of India's Nuclear Bomb. It looks at the secret history of India's bomb and considers what that can teach us about global proliferation. Perkovich directs the Secure World Program of the W. Alton Jones Foundation and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. An article in which you were quoted described you as being known in think tank circles as the father of non-weaponized deterrence. So now you have to explain what that means.
Well, non-weaponized deterrence was a phrase I coined to describe what India had in 1992 when I first went there. And that is that they basically had developed a nuclear capability so they could put nuclear weapons together if they needed to, and could then deliver them by aircraft against Pakistan. But they didn't put them, they didn't have them kept together. They had the basic capability, but they didn't put it all together. And that was conscious because they didn't think they needed to. They thought it was sufficient to have this know-how and wherewithal, but that there were a lot of risks associated with putting it all together, and a lot of expense associated with putting it all together. And they wanted to avoid that, which I thought was very enlightened. And so I thought it should be at least put across in a way and conceptualized in a way that people in the U.S. would start thinking about it, because we had a very different approach to nuclear weapons, that somehow you didn't have nuclear deterrence if you didn't have thousands of these things, you know, based on submarines and in airplanes flying around all the time. Anything less than that didn't count, which seems not true to me. And so I kind of coined this phrase to describe a different approach that India had followed.
So that would have enabled India to say, well, we don't have the bomb, but if you bomb us, we'll punish you a little later.
That's right, exactly. And again, I thought and still think there was wisdom in that, especially in the context of a rivalry with Pakistan, that no sane leader would want to do something that risks his country or major cities in his country being hit with nuclear weapons, whether it's 10 minutes or 2 days after the fact, that this is not worth the candle, especially in the end of the 20th century. And so as long as that was true, then what India did was a very effective thing, I thought. And for insane leaders, you can't deter them anyway. So don't talk about it. I thought there was a lot of wisdom to it, and one of the reasons why, I'm dismayed and saddened by some of the developments in the last year in India is that they're moving away from that to an explicit kind of mimicry of the way that the United States has approached nuclear weapons. And that's, I think, too bad. It's also going to cost them a lot.
Many of us who grew up during the Cold War in the 50s and had to go through those, like, nuclear drills in school and watch all the bomb shelters being built and everything, grew up having, like, nightmares about the possibility mm-hmm. of nuclear war. And we were exposed to all the horror movies about, you know, radioactive monsters as a result of atomic explosions and so on. So we were just, like, programmed to fear nuclear war. And it's been, you know, decades that there have been nuclear weapons. There haven't been dramatic accidents. There haven't been dramatic nuclear wars. And I think a generation or two is growing up without the kind of fear that the first post-nuclear generation grew up with. And I'm wondering if you think that sense of, well, hey, we've got them and things have been okay so far, is affecting the debate either in America or around the world about nuclear weapons.
I think that's a very good point. And I think there must be something to it, that there's a kind of a reassurance. You know, after all, you don't see nuclear weapons when you drive to work unless you're out in North Dakota or happen to be by a submarine base. So they're not present. And they haven't been used. Now, there are a number of instances where they were almost used by accident. So there have been many dangerous moments. But again, those are only found out years after the fact by getting declassified, you know, government documents and doing interviews. And then it doesn't make a lot of news. So people don't know how dangerously we've been living. But the result has been so far so good. And I think there is an element of reassurance in that. But it's, again, the question of, you know, will that go on forever? And if you don't do more things to explicitly devalue nuclear weapons, and you don't do more to reduce their number and lower the pace at which they're operated, then over time, the chances of more and more people getting them or wanting them grows. And as that happens, the probabilities go back up. And finally, I should say that though we're sanguine, there are big problems in Russia having to do not with Russian strength, but with Russian weakness. And the whole question about their control over their fissile materials from which you can make nuclear weapons, their warheads. We don't know how many tactical, these are small nuclear weapons, they have. By thousands, we don't know how many. And so there are real concerns about that. And it's possible that that becomes a metaphor for the danger in the future.
President Clinton is planning on visiting India in the year 2000, and that would make him the first American president to visit India since Carter went there in 1978. What is the significance of this visit? What do you think might happen?
Well, I think the significance of President Clinton's visit to India is actually great in the sense that Indians very much want to be recognized as an important country in the world and to be celebrated, as they should be, for having maintained democracy with a huge and diverse population. And they want this acknowledgement, especially from the United States as the most powerful country in the world, but also as a country where many of the Indian elite send their children to school, where there's a great potential for trade in the computer industry, where there is a great legacy of kind of scientific interaction. And so they welcome this kind of recognition that would be reflected in the president's visit. And I think that is overdue, that in fact many American presidents have not paid enough attention to India and not as much as India has deserved. So that's great. Now, I think the reason for this visit is that the president genuinely wants to go. So he's been chafing at the bit to go, and the bureaucracy at various points has for good reason said, well, wait a minute, the time isn't right, or maybe we can't afford to seem so eager to go after they didn't sign the test ban treaty. Of course, now that we haven't signed it, that argument goes away. But the president personally wants to go, and this is not going to be just a business visit. I mean, he really wants to see India and spend time there.
You spent time in India, interviewed a lot of people for your new book on India's nuclear bomb. Tell us a good story about interviewing somebody who told you something very revealing about the Indian nuclear weapons program.
Well, there were a number of fun stories, and a lot of this happens, drinking too much, because there are a number of people who were involved in these programs who kind of in the British tradition, many of them were educated in Britain, like to have a scotch at night or more than one. And so sometimes you would, get into these things, in frank ways. And I think there were a number of stories, but, one that was revealing was the former prime minister talked about basically, why India wanted nuclear weapons and why it was opposed to the test ban treaty in 1996. And he talked about meeting with President Clinton in New York at the UN a couple of years ago, and recalled walking by the Security Council room, and the sign said, Security Council. And he said, that he recalled to the president, there's a saying that we in India have a third eye. And when my third eye looks at that sign for the UN Security Council, it says another sign below it that says reserved for very rich countries or countries with the bomb. And, Mr. President, it's very hard to get very rich. And I think that there was something to that, that the bomb for them was a shortcut. There's actually one of my favorite stories was, or most illuminating stories, was in Pakistan, where I was having dinner with a very high-level military official in Pakistan. We were having dinner in this Chinese restaurant, and a bunch of security people and the driver kind of off to the side. And after we ate, he said, let me take you around Islamabad. And so we got in his car, and it was all darkened in the back. And the only light was coming from his cigarette, kind of this orange glow. And we're driving around and talking, and somehow the conversation got onto nuclear weapons and why they were so important to Pakistan. And he said, George, look, when the average Pakistani looks out the window or his door, he sees utter corruption. He sees economic failure. He sees pollution. He sees poverty. Anything he looks at basically doesn't work. The only thing that we've done that's been great is build nuclear weapons. And this is the only source of light in an otherwise incredibly bleak and dismal picture. And so we're just driving around in this quiet night, and I think there was a lot to that. And it stuck with me, in a sense, that we have to understand that kind of feeling towards nuclear weapons as well.
You understand it, but I doubt you feel very good about it.
No, because it's, you know, that story that, you know, it was disproved in a sense by the need for the coup they just had. I mean, in fact, you know, yes, they have nuclear weapons, but basically everything else is falling apart. And so it's a false sense of kind of wonder and accomplishment. And I think I think that is tragic. And I think, you know, in India, there's a better sense of proportion about it because India has actually accomplished more and is accomplishing more. It has an economy that's growing. It has, you know, brilliant universities in science and technology. It has a great software industry. And so there is a sense that the nuclear weapon isn't all that that they have. And it's actually that sense that I think has to be built upon in order to get beyond this.
Well, George Perkovich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
George Perkovich is the author of India's Nuclear Bomb, The Impact on Global Proliferation. Coming up, we remember writer Paul Bowles with a 1993 interview. He died today at the age of 88. This is Fresh Air. Writer and composer Paul Bowles died today of a heart attack at the age of 88. Paul Bowles was one of the more mysterious writers in American literature and one of the more enduring cult figures. Norman Mailer once wrote about him, "Bowles opened the world of hip. He let in the murder, the drugs, the incest." Tobias Wolff described Bowles' stories as austere, witty, violent, and sensuous, and described Bowles as one of our most serious and authentic literary talents. Bowles is best known for his 1949 novel, The Sheltering Sky, set like most of his nightmarish stories in northern Africa. It was adapted into a 1990 movie by Bernardo Bertolucci. Bowles lived in Tangiers, Morocco, for over 50 years. His presence helped make Tangiers a stop for many writers disenchanted with America, including William Burroughs, who wrote Naked Lunch there. I spoke with Bowles in 1993 when he was 82. He rarely gave interviews and, because of a bad leg, seldom left his apartment. He hadn't had a telephone for decades, but we were able to reach him through the phone of his downstairs neighbor. I asked him to describe what struck him most about Tangiers when he first visited in the early 30s.
Well, the way the Moroccans behaved, they all, as I watched them by the hour, because they all seemed to be performing for a theatrical audience, and they're wonderful doing that. That was something one could see at any moment of the day, anywhere. But above all, I loved their rituals, especially the religious brotherhoods, who were quite amazing. They still exist, but without the violence that they had back then.
What was the violence like within the religious brotherhoods?
Well, it depended on the brotherhood. The Isawa, they threw themselves into a nest of cactus. They ate scorpions. They bit off the heads of serpents. They bit off the top of a bottle and chewed it, swallowed it. It was very strange. I'd never seen anything like it. And not at all hoaxed, fake, no. They were not doing it for for an audience. They were doing it because it had to be done.
Well, the things that you were just talking about, the kind of violence and pain or transcendence of pain, I think relate to some of the imagery in some of your stories.
Yes, well, yes, of course. I was particularly taken by the attributes of certain of the manifestations, the ceremonies. The Jilala, another group, I've watched, they slash themselves, arms and legs, and so till they're completely painted red, and then they lose consciousness, fall on the floor. They're brought back to consciousness by different music, different rhythm of drum. And then they claim that they have left this world. They claim they're walking on air when they come to, which must be very pleasant.
You have stories about Westerners who go to faraway places and get into deep trouble once they get there, torture, enslavement. I mean, your story, A Distant Episode, is about a professor of linguistics who goes to a northern African village looking for interesting dialects.
That's right.
And he ends up with his tongue cut out, and he's basically made into a village performing pet. And after the wound heals, it takes quite a while before the more existential feeling of pain starts to stir in his being. I'm wondering if there were any, like, nightmarish experiences that were ever a part of your life by virtue of having moved from the West.
No, most of my experiences have been very pleasant. I invent nightmares to balance the pleasantness of life.
Have you ever been afraid of your imagination?
No. How would it feel? What would you do?
Try not to fall asleep, I think.
That would be a delightful way to live.
Your father was a dentist.
That's right.
And that must have been a pretty scary thing in a way. Kids always hate going to the dentist, but that was your father's job. So, I mean, and you think of the dentist as the person who administers pain.
That's right.
I'm wondering if this is, if there's any, I feel silly even
connection.
Asking this, any connection, yeah.
Probably, yes, although I never liked any dentist, and I liked my father least of all. And he wasn't, I didn't think he was a very pleasant, polite dentist, not with me anyway. He made me feel like a criminal.
For what?
The way he would open your mouth and give me orders as though I were evil. And that's the way he functioned.
Your father used to do your dental work?
Yes. Very bad.
It hurt a lot?
Oh, it always does. But I had more than that. He took me to an orthodontist. And for 10 years, I had the braces on my teeth, a band on each tooth and an arch inside and an arch outside because the canines were coming in too high up. You know, children that have malformed teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But mine all came out all right, of course, because of 10 years of going and having the screws on the arches tightened, and then it pulls all over your mouth, both upper and lower. Very painful, and you can't eat. So I don't know. I think perhaps it's just as well to have crooked teeth.
I want to get back to how you were or were not changed by living in Tangier. There's a character named Ahmet in The Sheltering Sky who says, life is amazing. Nothing ever happens the way one imagines it is going to. One realizes that most clearly here. All your philosophic systems crumble. At every turn, one finds the unexpected. When you got to Northern Africa, did your philosophic systems crumble? I mean, did...
I don't think I had any.
Uh-huh.
No. I didn't know what North Africa was. Gertrude Stein brought me here, sent me here. And
You had met her in Paris, and you asked her where you should go?
That's right. I was staying with her out in Bérignat, down near Aix-les-Bains. And she had a summer house, lovely place. And after about 2 weeks, she said, well, where are you going when you leave? And I said, well, I guess I'll go to Villefranche. And she said, oh, shame on you. Anybody can go there. And then we talked and talked. Finally, I think Alice Toklas said, why not Tangier? And Gertrude Stein said, it's a good idea. She liked it. She was here back long, long ago, I think the beginning of the century, which is quite a while ago. And she said, you'll like it. You like sunlight. You like heat. You'll get that there every day, all the time. I don't think she liked that, but I did, so I had a wonderful time. And I was with Aaron Copland. He wasn't very fond of Morocco.
You'd been studying with Aaron Copland.
Yes, I have, since the autumn of 1929, right.
You write that when you met Gertrude Stein, she said that you fascinated her because you seemed like the American suburban child with its unrelenting spleen. What do you think she meant?
Oh, I don't know. I remember she said, oh, you started your life of crime too young. Well, what the crime was, I don't know. She was a very amusing woman.
Very elliptical.
Oh, yes, you're never quite sure what she meant. But she always meant something. And generally, it was perfectly sensible.
We're listening to a 1993 interview with writer Paul Bowles. He died today at the age of 88. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with writer Paul Bowles. He died today at the age of 88. When we were talking before about the religious brotherhoods that you observed, do you think of yourself as a spiritually absorbed person?
I don't know what that means.
Spiritually concerned. Are you interested in things that are mystical or spiritual?
No, I'm not.
So your interest is more about the behavior of the people than in a kind of like spiritual seeking.
Well, I don't know what spiritual things are. You know, I don't really know. I know the word, yes. I've never come into contact with spiritual people.
Do you feel a lot like an outsider living in a country where a lot of people are very religious and the religion isn't at all close to the religion or to the religions that you grew up near?
I never grew up with any religion. My family were all agnostics back to the, all four of my grandparents, too, so I never had any connection with any orthodoxy, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had no religious instruction. I wasn't taught to believe in God. I wasn't taught to do anything. Naturally, I never did. If you don't tell a child while it's young that there is God, and all the rest of it goes with it, it's never going to invent it itself. It'll just go through life without an idea of it, which, of course, I think is preferable, but obviously millions of people don't. It's not that I have anything against religion, but I don't think it's a very good idea to force it into small children.
I know the thing I really wanted to ask you, if you have time for one more question, and I'm afraid this might be an unanswerable question. I think it might be too big a question, but let me give it a shot and feel free to tell me it's too big a question. Do you feel that you have been changed in any truly fundamental way by having uprooted yourself from the West and, moved to Tangier? And I'm also wondering if you wanted to be changed, if that's part of the reason why you moved so far away, if you wanted to be changed.
No. I never thought of myself as a person, what I wanted or didn't want, no. I always thought of myself as a recording machine. In order to want this or want that, you have to have an ego. And I don't think I have that.
You don't think you have an ego?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think of yourself as a person, you think of yourself as a recording machine.
That's right.
No desires?
To what?
I don't know, you name it. Eat, sleep.
Desire.
Yeah.
Well, when I'm hungry, I have a desire to eat. When I'm tired, I have a desire to sleep. Yes. But what you were speaking of desires which transcend that?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking of all desires, because you said you had no ego.
Well, it's a silly thing to say, but I never feel that it's terribly important if I get what I want or if I don't. And I'm not in competition with anyone else in the world. I just am living, and soon I'll be dead. that's the way life is.
You said that very matter-of-factly. I mean, is this something that you're fearful of or dreading or just...
What,
that's
death?
There it is? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't dread it. How can you dread something? Death is part of life. There's no life without it, so you might as well not dread it. Painful death, yes. A pacific, tranquil death, I think, fine.
Paul Bowles recorded in 1993. He died today of a heart attack at the age of 88. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Hogshead Beer and Wine of the Month clubs, select microbrews and wines delivered to home or offices. 3, 6, or 12-month subscriptions available. 800-795-BEER. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of Walkin' the Dog by Walter Mosley, now in hardcover wherever books are sold. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Bianculli on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, John Powers reviews Sleepy Hollow, and we preview our next installment of the American Popular Song Series, a tribute to Hoagie Carmichael. His centennial is Monday. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.